It's a real pleasure and honor to be here and to be invited here by the Royal Family in this wonderful, wonderful location. So today I'm going to talk about artificial intelligence and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about what's happening at the cutting edge of artificial intelligence as a field with particular reference to the work that we're doing at DeepMind. And then I want to end the talk with a personal passion of mine, which is the potential for applying AI to scientific discovery itself. So AI is the science of making machines smart. And at DeepMind, you know, as Robert mentioned, we were founded in 2010 in London. And it's hard to remember back 8 years, 8, 9 years ago now, that AI really wasn't talked about at all then. And actually, it was very difficult for us to even get our seed funding to get going, because AI was just coming out of what was called a winter period. So of course, the field of AI has been going for 50, 60 years, and it's gone through ups and downs, booms and busts. And you know, only recently has it become this sort of hugely popular and in some ways hyped up field that it is now. And we joined forces with Google in 2014 to potentially use Google's resources to turbocharge our mission, which I'll come to in a second. One way you can think about DeepMind was that our vision for it was a kind of Apollo program effort for AI. So we wanted to try to bring together the world's greatest scientists and all the different sub-disciplines that would be potentially useful for AI, so things like neuroscience, physics, mathematics, as well as computer science, and give them as much resources as possible, so compute power, data, and other things, and see how far we could push the state of the art. The other thing about DeepMind is that I always say we're working on two experiments, grand experiments. One, of course, is the building of the AI system. But the second one, which I think is equally important, is experimenting with the organizational design of DeepMind and how to do science. And maybe that's something that you know, I won't have time to talk about in my presentation, but something that maybe Robert and I, we can talk about in the Q&A. So what is DeepMind's mission? Well, we articulate it as a two-step process. Now, it's very simple to state, but hard to achieve. So step one, fundamentally solve intelligence. So what we would like to do is to understand natural intelligence and recreate that artificially. And then it's my belief, and always has been my belief, that if we can do step one, then step two, using it to solve everything else, naturally follows. Right? And this is something, again, I'm very happy to debate over dinner and afterwards. But the more I've thought about this, and I had this in mind since, you know, since I can remember, actually, since I was a kid in high school, I always wanted to dedicate my life to the pursuit of artificial intelligence. And it's because for this reason. Now, more prosaically, what does this mean? Well, what we're trying to do at DeepMind is to build the world's first general-purpose learning system. And let me just unpack a little bit what that means. So one of the reasons, in fact, this is the main reason why this new branch of AI has become so successful in the last decade. And it's because of this distinction between what's called learning systems and what's called expert systems. And I just want to explain a little bit about what these two systems are. So on the one hand, learning systems are systems that figure out solutions to problems from first principles. So they figure it out through direct experience and through experiencing the environment around them. And then they figure out for themselves the structure in that data and then potential solutions to problems they're confronted with. On the other hand, expert systems are systems that are hard-coded with specialized knowledge. So you can think of them as like databases. And that knowledge is input by a team of human programmers. So these are two very different approaches to creating smart systems. On the one hand, on the left-hand side, you create systems that can capable of learning for themselves. And on the right-hand side, you are with expert systems, you build in that intelligence directly. Now, the issue is that if you, with the expert systems, and this is the classical AI that has been going on sort of since the 50s, 1950s, is that it's very brittle, those systems. They can't deal with the unexpected, and they're limited to solutions that we can consciously express in code by the human programmers. right? So, and the reason I call it brittle is that if anything unexpected happens, which is always the case when you when a system interacts with the real world, especially with human beings, something unexpected happens that the programmers didn't cater for beforehand, then there's nothing the system can really do about that. It's just going to catastrophically fail. Right? If it hasn't got a rule in its database to deal with that situation, that eventuality, then it has nothing to fall back on. On the other hand, learning systems are able to deal with this kind of problem, the unexpected, quite gracefully, because they're already built from the ground up to deal with the to learn for themselves. So all the knowledge they have is knowledge that they've built, the system's built for itself and learned for itself. So if something new happens, it just needs to gather more data about that new situation, and potentially it can also incorporate solutions and learn solutions to that new situation. The other really cool thing about learning systems is they can potentially go beyond human knowledge. So if you think about it, expert systems are really limited by what we understand as human experts and programmers and scientists. So, you know, we have to solve a problem and then codify it as a program in the expert system approach. But a learning system can potentially learn something new and find some new structure in some sort of data that we didn't know was there, even as the creators of that system. And that's, of course, the immense promise of these types of learning systems, but also, we should touch on this too, potentially one of the scary aspects of these kinds of systems is they can go beyond the human knowledge. So, and what does that sort of mean then is that, well, expert systems were inspired by logic and mathematics. So that's what they're kind of based on, and that's what they were built out from. Whereas for learning systems, a lot of the inspiration for the architectures that we use come from neuroscience and the way our brains work. And indeed, that's why I studied neuroscience for my PhD, although I did computer science for my undergraduate. And DeepMind you can think of as a combination of these two fields. So we call it neuroscience-inspired artificial intelligence. So still the most famous and grandest example of successful expert system is the famous Deep Blue system that took on Garry Kasparov, the world chess champion at the time, in the late 90s. You'll probably all remember this match, 1997. And you know, Deep Blue is an incredible technical feat from IBM. And you know, it amazed the world by beating Kasparov. And you know, it was obviously a huge watershed moment for AI. But I was just finishing my undergrad at this point, and of course you can imagine I was very fascinated by this match because both from the chess player perspective and from the computer science perspective. And I actually came away from this match more impressed by Garry Kasparov's mind than I was with the machine. Because, of course, you know, you've got this brute of a machine, it's like a supercomputer that was built specially for this match. And Garry Kasparov, you know, with his 2 pounds of biological matter on his shoulders, was able to more or less match Deep Blue at chess. But of course, Garry Kasparov can do this myriad of other things, right? You know, he can speak 3 languages, he can drive cars, he can tie shoelaces, you know, all things. And what can Deep Blue do? Well, it can only play chess. And in fact, what's interesting is it can't even play a much simpler game like noughts and crosses. I don't know what you would call that in Holland, but hopefully you know what tic-tac-toe, right? And so, you know, nothing in the system that Deep Blue has would be helpful for playing any other game, even a much simpler game, let alone all of these wide variety of things that humans can do. So in some sense, I intuited when I was doing my undergraduate that this wasn't really artificial intelligence in some sense. It was missing some critical components of intelligence, what we would regard as intelligence, right? And I think those critical components were learning and the ability to learn and this notion of generality. Right, being able to operate out of the box across a wide range of tasks, which, of course, the human brain does both of those things effortlessly. And until very recently, most AI programs were not able to do that. So we would call those systems now narrow AI systems. They're systems that are built for one particular purpose and pre-programmed, hard-coded for that purpose with a bunch of heuristics. And I'll come back to the difference between Deep Blue and the modern systems, the kind of systems we're building towards the end of the talk. So how do we think about intelligence then? Well, we use this framework that's called reinforcement learning. I'm just going to briefly explain what reinforcement learning is to everybody with the aid of this simple diagram. So So reinforcement learning, we start off with thinking about the AI system. Now, at DeepMind, we call this the AI systems. We call them agents. And the agent finds itself in some sort of environment and is trying to achieve a goal in that environment, a goal specified by the programmers or the designers. Now, the environment could be the real world, in which case the agent will be a physical robot. Or the environment could be a virtual world, like a game or a simulation. And in that case, the agent, you can think of it as like a game avatar and or some sort of virtual robot. And in fact, we mostly use games for our tests and our development, because it's much more efficient than using robotics. And the agent only interacts with the environment in two ways. First of all, it gets observations about the environment through its sensory apparatus. So we mostly use vision. But you could use audio or touch and other sensors, other modalities, which we're exploring now. But we may think of it as vision. And the first job of the agent, there's two jobs of the AI system. First job is to build a model, a statistical model, of how the environment works based on these observations. Right? So it's you can think of it, it's continually getting information about how the world that it's in, the environment it's in, how does it work? What are the transitions between states? And it gets that information and is trying to build a predictive model of how that environment will work. Now, once it has that model, what can it do with the model? Well, the second part of the job of the agent system is to pick the right action to take at any moment in time. So it's, you know, the agent will have a set of available actions, and it's got to pick the right action, the best action, that will take it closest towards its overall goal, right? And so, and because this agents often act in a real-time system, it may be a certain amount of time it has to decide which action to take, and once that time's elapsed, it has to output the best action it's found so far. That action is executed, that may or may not make a change to the environment, and then that drives a new observation. And so this system operates in a cycle and continually improving itself as it gets new observations. Now, there's a few interesting features about this system. One is that the agent here is an active participant in its own learning. So what you can see here is the experiences the agent will get through its observations is going to be determined by the actions it takes. Right? So in some sense, the agent has to have some idea about what it's trying to learn and how it's trying to learn that. The other thing is that's important to note here is that if we could solve all the complexities behind this diagram, now this diagram looks pretty simple, but believe me, there are lots of very hard theoretical problems behind this diagram, but we do know that that would be enough for general intelligence, human-level general intelligence. And the reason we know that is because this is how biological systems learn. So this is how animals learn, including humans. And in humans, it's the dopamine neurons, the dopamine system in our brains that implements a form of reinforcement learning. So that's reinforcement learning, and that's how we think about intelligence. So the system is trying to learn through its experiences, and if it gets rewards, so if it ends up reaching a goal, it will get a reward, and then it will reinforce the actions it took in order to get to that goal. So what that means is next time it's in that same situation, it will pick the action that it took last time that actually ended up with a reward. So it's statistically more likely to pick that action in the future. So we took that kind of simple idea in some sense and we scaled it up into a very large system. So we call this system DQN, and another aspect of our approach at DeepMind, our philosophy to AI, is that we believe a true thinking machine has to be embedded in a sensory motor reality, a sensory motor stream. So whether, of course, a real robot is automatically embedded in a sensory motor reality because it's in the real world with real sensors. But you can also do this in a virtual world if you're very careful. If you treat the virtual avatar as like a real robot, so it only gets information through its sensors, so it's through its virtual sensors, rather than having privileged information about the game state itself, then it's like as if it was a real robot, but now in a simulation. So we do that, and then we use actually commercially available computer games to test our algorithms and see how smart they're getting. And this is a lot more efficient than using robots. I know some of you in the audience are AI experts here and maybe use robotics. We think robotics is going to be a very important application area of AI, but we prefer to do the development and the theory work in simulation because you can get much faster research cycles in simulation. And that's for all sorts of reasons. Unlimited training data, we can test multiple systems in parallel. All of these things are quite difficult to do with robotics. So I'm going to show you a little video of how the AI system works. But before I show you that, I just want to explain to you exactly what you're going to see. So the first system we tested this on was the classic Atari games from the 1980s. So these Atari games are really the first famous games consoles. And some of you might remember them quite fondly from the 80s. And what I'm going to show you is the AI system learning how to play these games. And the key thing here is that the AI system only gets the raw pixels, the pixel numbers, intensities, as the inputs. It doesn't know anything about the rules of the game. It doesn't know what it's controlling. It doesn't know how to get points. It just knows that this is a stream of numbers coming into it. And the goal we give it is simply to maximize the score, get the highest score possible. So it learns everything from first principles, from scratch, directly from this sensory data. And then we insist on this second thing of this notion of generality. So a single system, a single algorithm, out of the box, playing all the multiple hundreds of different Atari games that there are, each of them very, very different types of games. So I'm going to show you a video now of the Atari system learning over time. So this game's called Breakout. The idea of this game is that you control the bat at the bottom of the screen, the little pink bat, and you can move that left and right, and you're trying to use this pink ball to break through a rainbow-colored wall. Now, if the ball goes past your bat, then you lose a life, so you have three lives, and you're trying to knock out all the bricks from the wall. So I'm going to show you the system getting better over time as it starts learning about how to play this game. So this is after 100 games. It's played 100 games now. And you can see it's not very good yet. It's missing the ball most of the time. But it's starting to get the idea that the bat should move towards the ball. That's maybe it's a good idea. Now, after 300 games, there's still not that many games. Now it's playing the game as well as any human can basically play it. So it's always getting the ball back, even at very fast angles. You can see it's pretty good at getting the ball back. So we thought that was pretty cool. But what would happen if we left it playing another 200 games? And this amazing thing happened. After 500 games, it discovered the optimal strategy was to dig a tunnel around the left-hand side of the wall and then send the ball around the back of the wall. Right? So you can see how it's doing that with superhuman accuracy. And what was amazing is that the researchers who built this program, incredible researchers, but they're not so good at Atari games, so they didn't know this solution. And so this was the first aha moment for us where we learned something from our own system. Right? And it's the first time, it's happened many times since then, but this was the first time around 5 years ago when that happened. So DQN, we published this as our first big paper in Nature. It was a Nature front cover, and it became quite a lot of news. And we applied this system to all the different Atari games, all the classic ones you remember from Space Invaders and Pac-Man and so on. And it can master all of these games out of the box with no change, just plays them. So we then scaled the system up even further. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about probably our most famous program, which Robert mentioned, which is called AlphaGo. Now, AlphaGo, we completed this program about 2 years ago. And the AlphaGo was our program to play the ancient Oriental game of Go. Now, this is what the Go board looks like, for those of you who don't know what Go is. It's played on a 19 by 19 board, and you play with these black and white stones. You take turns playing on the board. The board starts empty, and then it fills up with stones. And this is the oldest game humanity has played, so it's 3,000 years old, and it's probably the most complex game we've ever invented as well. It's complex but elegant. So it only has two rules, and I could teach you it in 5 minutes. I'm not going to do that now because I don't have that 5 minutes. But it's a fascinating game, which I encourage you to look into. In China and Korea and Japan, so in the Asian countries, this takes the kind of intellectual space, cultural space, that chess does in the West. So this is what they play. They all play Go instead of chess. And the idea of the game is that once the board fills up like this, so this is the end of a game. You're trying to surround empty areas of space, territory, it's called, with your stones. So with white, you're trying to, and black, you're trying to build these walls of stones that surround areas of the board. And then you count up the amounts of territory that you've surrounded, the number of points you've surrounded, and that's your final score. And the person who has a higher score wins the game. So in this case, it's very close, actually, but white wins this by 1 point, a single point. Now, Go is long been one of the holy grails of AI research. So after that Deep Blue match I talked to you about earlier in the late 90s, Go became the next Mount Everest, because chess had been sort of cracked, and Go was the kind of remaining game left that it didn't seem to be amenable to the kinds of approaches, the expert system approaches I talked about at the beginning. So why is that? Well, there's two main reasons that Go is a lot harder than chess. So one is this enormous complexity, which you can see here. The easiest way to think about that is the size of the search space. So there are more possible positions in Go than there are atoms in the universe, right? So just think about that for a minute. So there's 10 to the power 170 possible Go positions, and there's around 10 to the power 80 atoms in the observable universe. So what that means is, even if you took all the world's computers and you ran them for a million years, that still wouldn't be enough compute power to brute force a solution to Go, right? So it's just not amenable to the kind of brute force approaches that chess worked for chess. Now, the second thing that's even harder was that for a long time, and actually still today, it was thought to be impossible to directly write a set of rules called an evaluation function that would allow the computer system to evaluate whether black or white was winning in the current position. Right, and that's critical for any games-playing computer system to work. Right, so Deep Blue, all chess computers have an evaluation function that's been hand-programmed by a team of grandmasters and a team of programmers, and they try and encapsulate all the knowledge that the human grandmasters have in a bunch of rules that will allow the system to figure out, in this next position, if I play this move, is that a good position for me or for my opponent? Right, so you can see that's critical to deciding what plan you're going to have. Now, in chess, this is relatively easy to do, because chess is basically a game about calculation. But in Go, it's a much more intuitive game. It isn't really about calculating plans out. You more have to feel about patterns. And you can see from the Go board, Go itself is a much more artistic and esoteric game than chess. It only has one piece, and it's all about the configurations of those pieces, rather than in chess, where you have different pieces like kings and queens and rooks and so on, and they all have different powers, and you can calculate what they do. So for 20 years, people have been trying to build Go programs in the same way they built the chess programs, and it got nowhere. And so we thought this would be a great thing for us to take on. And we solved this problem with AlphaGo by using two neural networks to take care of those two different issues. So neural networks are this new type of approach to AI that's loosely modeled on how the brain works, and effectively models a hierarchy of layered neurons like the brain has. And we use two of these, and they learn through experience, and they change their links between the neurons, just like our brains change our links, the synaptic links between neurons in our brains as we learn things. These neural networks do that as well. And we train two. One neural network is called the policy network, which learned to, in a position, to work out which are the top five moves that are most likely to be played by a human expert. And so instead of having to search all the different possible moves in that position, you can narrow it down to, say, just look at the top three or the top five. The second network that we created was called the value network. And this is the network that, after millions of games get playing against itself, so it learns incrementally by playing against itself and making mistakes and learning what mistakes lead to losses and which moves lead to wins. It can figure out over time what positions are likely to end up becoming a winning position for their own side, and which ones are going to end up being losing. And we can train a neural network called the value network to give a prediction. Given a particular board position here in blue, we can give it any board position, and it will give a prediction between 0 and 1 who is likely to win from this position and the confidence in that judgment. So 1 would mean black is going to win for certain, 0 would mean white is going to win for certain, and 0.5 would mean that the position is even. And so what we did here is, instead of directly programming in an evaluation function, we let the system learn for itself through playing millions of games against itself. And learning from those mistakes, it learned for itself how to evaluate Go positions. So once we built that system, we then took it up to the biggest challenge of all, which was to take on the world champion at Go, this amazing South Korean grandmaster called Lee Sedol. And we challenged her. We had a $1 million challenge match, much like the Deep Blue versus Kasparov match. We played this match in Seoul in 2016. And it was a really huge event, much bigger actually even than the Deep Blue Kasparov match in Asia. Over 200 million viewers watched the five-game match. And no one gave the program a chance, AlphaGo, because you have to understand up till this match and up to AlphaGo, no program had ever beaten a professional player at all, let alone the world champion. Right? So this is kind of an unthinkable leap. So, and in fact, Lee Sedol himself predicted before the match that he would win 5-0. In fact, what happened is that AlphaGo won 4-1. And many of the experts in both AI and Go both proclaimed that it was a decade before its time. And those of you who are familiar with technology and do engineering and science know that things almost never happen a decade before you expect. It's always usually a decade after you expect it to happen. So this is surprising even for us. Now, the key thing is not actually so important that AlphaGo won. Of course, that was what we were trying to do. But what was unexpected for us was how AlphaGo won and actually the types of moves that it played. So it wasn't just regurgitating human ideas of how to play Go. It actually displayed incredible creativity and came up with new ideas for itself. This is what amazed the Go world, was not only the win, was actually the quality of the games. Now, I'll just give you one example of that here. This is probably the most famous game that's going to go down in Go history. And one thing you have to know about Go is there's an incredible 3,000-year tradition. And there are some famous games, especially from the Japanese Edo period, where they're revered games that every Go player studies. Right? So these are kind of like legendary games. They're like works of art. They're like Shakespeare plays. And you as a top world champion or top Go player, you live your whole career to try and play one of these games, right? Or one of these moves. They're sometimes called divine moves because they're sort of inspired by God in some sense, right? Because even the Go players themselves can't necessarily explain why they've made that move. It just felt right, right? This is why Go is much more intuitive than chess. And so this is a position from game two, and it's move 37. And AlphaGo is black, and Lee Sedol is white. And AlphaGo played this move here in move 37. And the reason this shocked the whole Go world. So if you go back and watch on YouTube how the commentators reacted, they literally fell off their chair when they saw this move, like literally fell off their chair. And they thought AlphaGo was, was a terrible program, right? Because they still weren't sure how strong it was. So they just thought this is just nonsense. And the reason this is nonsense is because there are two key lines on a Go board, the third and the fourth line. So this is the fifth line actually. So the third and fourth line are where you play if you're playing Go properly in the opening. Those are the critical lines. And AlphaGo on move 37 played here on the fifth line. So the fifth line in from the side. And this is thought to be terrible. So there are Japanese proverbs that tell you never to play on the fifth line in the opening. Right? So this is goes against thousands of years of wisdom, received wisdom. And yet AlphaGo decided to play here. Now, the thing about creativity is, we could all of us here, even if you don't play Go, we could play an original move by playing a random move, right? That would make no sense to the Go experts. Now, that isn't what makes this move creative. It's not just new. What I like about Go is that it's kind of like art. In fact, it's regarded as an art form in Asia, but it's like objective art. Because you don't have to be subjective, is that a nice move or not? It's objectively, did it help you win the game? Did it end up making a difference to the game? That's how you know if it was a truly creative, innovative move. And in fact, move 37 did end up tipping the game in AlphaGo's favor about 100 moves later. So what happened is that these two stones down here in the bottom left that are miles away from that move 37, 100 moves later, the fighting from the bottom left corner spilled out into the center of the board and then eventually connected up with that move 37 stone. And it was in the perfect position to decide that battle decisively, which won AlphaGo the game. So it was almost as if AlphaGo had presciently thought ahead, 100 moves ahead of time, and put that stone in the perfect place to decide that battle. So Lisa Dole was amazed by this. He was also incredibly inspired by that match. He also, of course, he won one match, game four, with his own incredible creative move. And he said it was an unforgettable experience. And if you're interested in finding out more about it, I'd encourage you to view this independent documentary called AlphaGo on Netflix, which has won all sorts of film festival prizes. This amazing director put it together from raw footage. And you'll see the impact it had on the whole of the Go community in Korea and China. So we then went a step further with all this work, and we just recently created our latest version, which we call AlphaZero. And AlphaZero has several improvements over AlphaGo. It's completely generalized for AlphaGo to play any two-player game. So this was always the holy grail for me as a chess player and then a computer scientist. I wanted a program that would address the flaws that Deep Blue had, what I said at the beginning. Deep Blue could only play chess. It couldn't even play noughts and crosses. Well, AlphaZero can play any two-player game. So all two-player games, two-player games, are now solved, including chess and Japanese chess, which is both played professionally. Japanese chess is also played professionally in Japan. And so, and what they can do is they learn completely from scratch, AlphaZero. So it doesn't need any human data at all. The original version of AlphaGo had to learn, started its learning by looking at human expert games. AlphaZero starts from random. It literally starts from random play, and then after a few million games, which you can play in a few hours, because it plays it very fast, like one game can finish in a matter of milliseconds, and it learns from that its own evaluations about how to play the game. And then we tested, this is the sort of the ultimate thing for us, we tested AlphaZero, which learned for itself, we tested it against the current computer chess champion, which is called Stockfish, which is way, way stronger than Deep Blue and way stronger than the human world champion, right? So for those of you who know about chess, this ELO rating for Stockfish is about 3,600. So no current human world champion, Magnus Carlsen, would stand a chance against Stockfish, nor would Deep Blue. And Stockfish is an inheritor of the Deep Blue type of programs. There's actually 1,000 heuristic rules inbuilt into Stockfish for it to play chess, 1,000 rules. And it's been you can think of it as 30 years of cumulative programming that's gone into it. And AlphaZero beat Stockfish in a 100-game match 28-0. So 28 wins, 0 losses, 72 draws, which is unheard of. So Stockfish is the most powerful chess-playing entity in the world. And AlphaZero beat it after just 4 hours of training. So it started from random, and then after 4 hours of playing against itself, it was able to beat the strongest computer program we've ever created. And what was interesting is, not only did it win, it also created a new style of playing chess. So for those of you who know chess, there's some amazing YouTube commentaries by chess grandmasters. We released 10 games, and they've already gone down in chess sort of history about how it plays chess. And I haven't got time to explain this, but basically the key about AlphaZero is it favors mobility of its pieces rather than favoring materiality. So most chess computers like grabbing pawns and material and then holding on to that material and trying to defend itself. AlphaZero likes playing sacrifices and it goes for maximum mobility of its pieces. So it plays this very beautiful style, a very human style, actually. So so that's now kind of shocked the chess world that there was enough room in chess for a whole new style to be invented. Now, we've had many successes, but there are huge challenges that remain before we get anywhere close to human-level AI, including things like memory, imagination, learning of abstract concepts, and, of course, understanding language. And we're working on all of these topics today at DeepMind and of course, our other colleagues in other companies and academia. So what are we going to use these systems for? Well, we test them on games, but of course, the idea of building these systems is not for us to solve games. That's just our development platform. What we want to do is build general algorithms that can be applied to the real world. And what I'm particularly passionate about is applying them to science and medicine. And actually, these kinds of algorithms have been applied by us and other groups around the world to really diverse set of things already today. from exoplanet discovery to controlling plasma and nuclear fusion to chemical synthesis, building new chemical compounds, to detecting macular degeneration from retina scans. And some of this work, which is that work we've been doing with Moorfields Hospital in the UK. So there's a huge diverse range, and that's just touching on a small sample of the kinds of things that this kind of we believe this kind of AI system could be applied to. So there are many other scientific applications I think we're going to see in the next 5 to 10 years. AI-assisted drug design, the design of nanomaterials, and in all sorts of biotech and genomics and other places where there's huge amounts of data that we have to make sense of. And in fact, even with the systems today, they can be applied to, I think, a myriad of problems that satisfy three properties. So property one, a massive combinatorial search space that the human experts are trying to navigate. So Go is a perfect example of that. Number two, you've got to have a clear objective function or metric that you can specify that you want to optimize against. So of course, games are very nice for this because they have scores, and you win and you lose. So those are very clear, those metrics. But in a lot of areas of science, you can also come up with clear metrics, like minimizing energy, for example, is a good one for a lot of biological and material sciences. And then thirdly, you need either lots of data to train your system on, or, which is what we do at DeepMind a lot, build or have access to an accurate and efficient simulation of the real-world system. So if you have a system or a problem that satisfies these three constraints or properties, then those are good candidates to apply these reinforcement learning, deep reinforcement learning techniques to. Of course, we're also applying this to the commercial world and the real world. We work with the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK, in all sorts of medical diagnostics. We've used our systems to save energy in Google's data centers. So we control the cooling systems in the data centers. So we managed to save 40% of the energy the data center uses by more efficiently controlling the cooling systems. And then another area I'm quite passionate about is applying AI to education itself and personalizing education. So just to finish then, just to go back to sort of the second part of our two-part plan, you know, I've always been obsessed, if you like, with AI because I think of AI as a kind of meta-solution to all the other problems that we have in science. So, you know, I think some of the huge challenges facing us as society today, both in our private lives and our professional lives as scientists, is information overload and system complexity. Just the systems we would like to understand, whether that's economics or climate, they're just so complicated now. It's very difficult for human experts, even teams of the smartest humans, to understand those systems without some kind of powerful tool aiding them. And in a sense, big data, which was the buzzword of the first decade of the 2000s, I see it in a way as the problem, and AI is the answer, right? We all have big data, all companies have huge data, governments have huge data, but what do you do with all that data? How do you find the insights in that data? So you can think of intelligence, general intelligence, as a kind of automatic process that converts unstructured information into useful, actionable knowledge. That's what I think intelligence is at its heart. And the dream for me is to make AI-assisted science and medicine possible, or perhaps even build AI scientists that can work alongside their human counterparts. And then the neuroscientists in me, I hope that by distilling AI into a sort of algorithmic construct and then comparing that to the human brain, that will reveal some of the mysteries of our own human minds, the unique parts of our human minds, things like dreaming, creativity, and perhaps even consciousness. So I think AI holds enormous promise for the future, and these are really exciting times to sort of be in this industry and to be doing science. But of course, it comes with one word of caution, which is that, you know, we believe, as with all powerful technologies, AI must be built responsibly and safely and be used for the benefit of everyone in society. And we've been at the forefront of advocating for this and doing the research on this and, you know, including meaningful public engagement, you know, doing talks like this. And we've been part of setting up various partnerships and societies that are starting to look into this. And I think this is going to become an increasingly important area over time. Thanks for listening.